Steve, thanks for talking to IME and New Economic School of Georgia. Is it possible to date the emergence of the nanny state?
Well, if by that you mean the emergence of the welfare state, the answer is quite complicated because political authorities have had a welfare function for a long time historically. So in the ancient world, such as the Roman Empire or previous ancient states, a major function of the state was to provide corn doles, free supplies of things like olive oil and bread, basic necessities of life, to their citizens. This remained the case in the Byzantine Empire right up until the 13th century, for example, where if you could prove that you were a citizen of Constantinople, you got free olive oil and grain from the imperial storehouses. During the Middle Ages, however, in Europe, and this has been the case in many other parts of the world as well, this was no longer done by the political authorities. So relief of poverty was in the hands of the church. In the Islamic world, it was done through zakat, through private charity, which is an obligatory duty on Muslims.
So, zakat is not a pure tax. It's a ticket to heaven.
Yes, indeed. It's one of the five pillars of Islam. It's one of the five things that Muslims have to do. And the Islamic jurists are very clear, actually, that although the state may collect it, it's actually voluntary, because God is not interested in forced charity. He's only interested in genuine voluntary
and
giving.
And in this respect, Islam is very similar to the Bible.
Indeed, indeed. That's the same view that they all have. So up until the 19th century most, and or late 18th century in most parts of the world, poor relief is not done through the state. It's done through non-state means, the church or charities or activity of some kind. But then during the 19th century, you get the growth of the modern kind of welfare state. And the critical date, I think, is 1873, when Bismarck introduces modern state insurance for health and old age. And that really is the point at which the modern welfare state comes into existence.
I read, I think it was James Bartholomew, the welfare state we are in. He's mentioning the story of the nationalization or whatever of the monasteries during the times of Henry VIII, and explains how deprivation of the monasteries from the function and of taking care to elderly, sick, and homeless led to a series of problems until the times of Elizabeth.
This is true, and what happened, the result, the solution was to pass something called the Poor Law in 1603, which said that every parish in the country had a responsibility to provide relief for its own poor. And this was actually an extremely bad system right from the start, not least because it meant that in order to prevent people going from poor parishes to rich parishes, you had to back it up with what were called the laws of settlement, which said that you really could not move around the country to look for work where it was most available. You had to stay in the parish in which you had been born. And so if poor people who needed poor relief were found outside their parish of origin, the law stated that they should be whipped and then sent back to their home parish. Now obviously this was not often enforced, but the system was clearly not good in any sense, whether in terms of human rights or economic productivity. And then latterly it became very bad, because in the later 18th and early 19th century they adopted a thing called the Speen-Hamlin system, which was essentially a system whereby the magistrates in part of a county would subsidise the wages of poorly paid labourers with cash payments. The amount that you got was dependent on the price of bread in a complicated way. And by the time you get to the later 1820s, in some parts of England, as many as 40% of the population are in receipt of poor relief of this kind. 40%. Yes. So the situation is absolutely catastrophic, in fact. And the result was that in 1834, Parliament completely reformed the system with the Poor Law Amendment Act. And what this stipulated was that the condition of somebody in receipt of poor relief must always be worse than that of the lowest paid labourer, what they called less eligibility. So in other words, there had to be an incentive to work. And that you could also only get poor relief if you went into a workhouse, an institution. You were no longer allowed to get cash handouts on the local taxpayer. And the whole system of subsidising wages, which had the effect of keeping wages down, of course, was scrapped.
And the modern days United Kingdom, the system was introduced copying the the German, the Bismarckian model.
In
1910.
1910 by Lloyd George in the People's Budget. The budget was actually in 1909, but it was passed eventually in 1910. And that introduced compulsory health insurance, unemployment and sickness insurance. And this was then enormously enlarged following the Beveridge Report in 1942 by the post-war Labour government in 1946 when they set up the modern welfare state. However, there's been a change since then because the initial welfare state in the UK was contribution-based. Like the Bismarckian one, it was based on state-collected insurance payments. So taxpayers would make payments to the state and they would then get benefits in the case of unemployment or sickness or old age in proportion to the amount of contributions they had made. From about the 1970s onwards, the British welfare state, like most welfare states in Europe and North America, moved away from a contributory system and moved towards a system of welfare payments being given in accordance with need, defined by supposedly objective criteria, like how many children you had, for example.
And these are fiscal transfers.
These are fiscal transfers, and they're now done on the basis not of entitlements, not on the basis of contributions, but purely on the basis of need. And this has proved to be extremely destructive, because, amongst other things, it's created a very severe poverty trap, whereby if you are on low income, sorry, if you are unemployed, for example, and you then take a low-paid job, because you lose welfare benefits, you actually are facing a marginal tax rate in excess of 90% in most cases.
So in one of your works, I think, of 10 years ago, you spoke about the origins of the healthcare fascism, or health fascism.
Mm-hmm.
How it is different, the definition of the health fascism, you know, to welfare state.
This is a different thing.
There is a byproduct.
There is a connection, which is that if you have a state-provided healthcare, then ill health arising out of personal choices imposes costs on the taxpayer. And this is then taken as the basis for having the state regulate behaviour like smoking, for example, or the diet that you have, or whether or not you take exercise, on the grounds that if you make unhealthy decisions, you're going to impose costs on the taxpayer. However, that's not the ultimate origin of this. The principle of health fascism, which I'll define in a moment, actually appears first before the welfare state really gets going. The basic idea is that in some sense you belong to the state and it is your duty to be as productive and useful a member of the political society as you can be. What this means is that you do not really control your own life choices, that the government has a responsibility to keep you healthy, no matter whether you want to be healthy or not. And also that you should not be able to do whatever you like, because if you make decisions that impair your health, it means you're a less productive member of society, and therefore basically you're letting down part of your public responsibility. And this is an idea which actually goes back to Prussia, and also to Sweden. It's Prussia and Sweden that historically both had this idea for a very long time, back from the 18th century in fact. But it's now expanded enormously in the contemporary world, where governments are constantly trying to regulate or seeking to regulate things like diet, smoking, lifestyle choices, health, and exercise and the like, in order to make their citizens, they think, healthier.
So the Nazi doctor's policy of basically exterminating the unfit, it's probably a continuation of this tradition you've mentioned.
Indeed.
But it's a continuation which brings a new quality of the system, or it's somehow intrinsic to the original
idea? I think it's intrinsic to the original idea, but it's only really during the interwar period that it really finds full expression, and not only in Germany. In the United States, more than 30 states, for example, in the 1930s, have laws which provide for the forcible sterilization of the, quote, unfit, unquote. In Sweden, the unfit were being incarcerated and compulsorily sterilized until as recently as the 1970s. And in the United Kingdom, there was a major move to give the Home Secretary quite draconian and extreme powers to forcibly sterilize the unfit and confine them to institutions in 1921. Fortunately, in the British case, the Labour Party was strongly hostile to this, and it was because of the opposition from the Labour Party, it never actually succeeded politically in the way in which it did in many other parts of the world. So the Nazis are actually only the most extreme and virulent end of a much wider spectrum of health fascism in the interwar years, which in fact persists after the end of World War II in many parts of the world, like Sweden.
So, and then regulating the diet or the smoking habits or drinking habits. I mean, the strange thing in my point of view, given the background and given the logic of the human body, so to say, it belongs to the individual, it doesn't belong to the state, and the state has nothing to do with the production of children, for example, or production bodies. So, what is striking to me, why? Opposite to this logic, you know, the smoking bans and diet regulation, regulation of drinking habits and that sort of stuff is so popular and basically accepted without much of an argument.
Well, there's two different questions there. One is why is it justified? In other words, what is the argument used to justify this on the part of governments? And I think there are a number of arguments. One of them is that many intellectual and political elites actually reject your premise that you own your own body. They do not accept this. They think that you're a purely social animal, and that in some sense your body and your life choices that you make about it are a matter of public concern and therefore a political concern. So there's an actual intellectual case made on that basis. Another assumption, though, which I think comes from the medical profession, is the idea that health is an almost infinitely valuable good, and that therefore you do not make trade-offs between health and other goods such as pleasure, entertainment, excitement, or whatever it might be. The reality, of course, as our everyday decisions show, is that this is not the case, because anyone who chooses to smoke has clearly chosen to privilege the pleasure of smoking, the benefits smoking brings to them in terms of calmness and the like, over longer-term health considerations. However, doctors in particular are, for obvious reasons, I think, very keen on the idea that health is somehow a good to which regular economic considerations don't apply, and that therefore almost anything is justified in trying to promote health and discourage ill health. And the final element of the sort of justificatory argument is the argument which increasingly draws on behavioural economics, that human beings are not rational choosers, and that therefore we choose to do things like smoke or have an unhealthy diet, but we don't really want to do this. What we really want to do is something else, but we're too weak-willed to do that. And so if the state forces us to do something else, there is actually only something that we really would want to do anyway. So that is the argument that's made.
In Bulgaria, there was another argument that the smokers, for example, are free riders on the healthcare system.
Well, this is the argument I made earlier, the point I pointed out to you. Once you have a state-provided healthcare system, there is actually an argument to the effect that if you are a smoker, you are imposing costs on the rest of society, and therefore there's a political interest in regulating you. In many cases, actually, the taxes paid by smokers are actually greater than the costs of smoking-related illness to the healthcare system. And in any event, also, if you want to get into that kind of game, the obvious rejoinder is that to the extent that smoking and other things make you die earlier than you otherwise would do, you're saving the state an enormous amount of money in pensions. But then there's a different question, which you sort of alluded to, which is that of, never mind the arguments that the doctors or the politicians have for doing this, why do people put up with it? In other words, why, for example, in Ireland, did the Irish, supposedly a fairly rebellious people, just meekly accept being told they could no longer smoke indoors? And I think it simply has to do with the general power and legitimacy of the modern state. And also herd effects. Essentially, nobody wants to be the one person who challenges the law and then suffers penalty. You have to reach a tipping point where there's mass disobedience before a law will not be obeyed. But I think what it does show is just how strong the legitimacy of modern welfare states actually is. People may grumble about these laws, they may complain, but they're not going to disobey them.
Oh, and the same law works very well in Turkey.
Yes.
Turkey being notorious, you know, for its whatever, more or less liberal, whatever, business regime, you know, you basically start a business, you do relatively okay without any interference of the government, besides, of course, you know, certain areas. So, but the effect of the implementation of the law was absolutely the same as in Ireland. So probably this is really the legitimacy of the conversion.
I think also in terms of smoking, a critical turning point was the acceptance of the argument, which I think is actually scientifically unfounded, but let's not go into that, that of passive smoking, because that enabled the non-smokers to claim that in fact the smokers are imposing serious ill health costs upon them, and that therefore they should not be allowed to do it in enclosed spaces. And I think the acceptance that there was such a thing as passive smoking health risks basically changed the nature of the arguments. So I think had they tried to put through this smoking ban before passive smoking became a widespread concern, there would have been much more resistance to it. But in fact, once that argument had gained ground, it took away a lot of the basis for resistance.
And here we come to my last question. You know, there are different organizations and different initiatives, you know, to resist, you know, these whatever exemplifications of a welfare state and the health fascism. For example, the Forest Organization, I'm a member of that.
Yes,
I used to know Lord Harris. So how successful they are?
They're not as successful as they should be, really. They have some success, but it's more in mobilising small groups of people. They've not been very successful, I think it's fair to say, in affecting the larger public debate. There are two problems, I think. The first is that they are seen as being special pleaders for special interests, particularly the tobacco industry. The other problem is that, generally speaking, every issue is fought on its own. I remember when my friend, the late Chris Tain, was running Forest, he was constantly arguing with the funders of Forest that they should not just talk about smoking, that they should also talk about alcohol, they should talk about diet, they should talk about health in general. But they were very resistant to doing this. And the point is that as long as each of these separate issues is treated as an independent freestanding issue rather than as part of the more wide encompassing problem of health fascism, of political elites' attempts to control life choices on the basis of arguments about health, people will be picked off one by one. It's a classic case of we must all hang together or we will all hang separately. Or, you know, the famous Pastor Niemöller quote, you know, when they came for the Jews, I didn't complain because I was not a Jew, and so on.
Yeah.
Similarly, when they came for the smokers, I didn't complain because I was not a smoker, but then they came for the drinkers and I didn't complain, and so on. So I think that to be more successful, resistance like this has to be more generalised rather than concentrating on just the specific issues. And also, it needs to have a wider base of funding than just the industries such as tobacco or alcohol that's specifically affected by it. It needs to attract more general funding and activism from people who want to assert individual independence and autonomy against these ideas of collectivism and responsibility to some overarching society that controls what you do with your life.
Do you think it's really the last question? Do you think it might be some sort of a key topic in the agenda of, say, libertarian movement?
I think it should be, because this is actually the most dangerous area for expansion of state power, I think, at the moment. And it gives the modern welfare state, in particular, the capacity to intervene into areas of life which have not previously been thought to be the subject of politics. So that had you suggested, say, 40, 50 years ago, that the state would concern itself with what kind of food you ate or what kind of exercise regime you had, most people, including most socialists, would have been utterly incredulous and horrified at this idea. So this is an extremely dangerous and important development, because it means that now large areas of life, which were previously thought of as completely private, are now being politicized.
And it obviously has, you know, as a byproduct, you know, a reverse impact on other important policies like taxation, you know, decision making on issues which are not in their
responsibility. Yes, indeed.
The constitutional responsibilities.
And also, from a purely pragmatic point of view, if you want to promote libertarian ideas, these are actual issues which involve and affect many people directly, personally, and immediately. And it's an avenue through which you can spread the ideas of autonomy and individualism and individual independence to people who are not going to be persuaded by, for example, straightforward economic arguments, because they're either not interested or they find it hard to follow them, whereas they can find an argument that the government has no business stopping them smoking or drinking very easy to take and accept.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.